All right. Good afternoon. Thank you for hanging in here. So it's my pleasure to be here from Portland, Oregon. The title of my talk is Applying Community-Based Participatory Research to Local Policy Change, Lessons Learned from a Social Justice Regional Foundation. That is a picture of our state capitol in Salem. I do think gray is beautiful, but honestly, no, we have great, beautiful weather, contrary to popular belief, so you'll see a little bit more about that. I have no relationships to disclose. Today, I want to discuss three major things: application of CPPR to advance policy, and really from a funder's perspective, honestly, and sort of vantage points for doing so. I really want to discuss and compare some process and policy outcomes using more a case study, methodology, but really then get to implications for both public health practitioners and funders, if there are any funders in the room. Quickly, just a little bit about Northwest Health Foundation. We have been around since 1997. We're a conversion foundation. The proceeds of our endowment were when a not-for-profit health plan was bought out for a for-profit entity, and proceeds of that were to be put into a fund to invest back in the community. Our mission hasn't changed since 1997. It's simply, but boldly, to advance and promote the health of the people of Oregon and Southwest Washington. But our work has certainly evolved, which I'll tell you a little bit more about today. We have three major focus areas. One is healthcare reform, mostly through policy change. We both mean through the traditional delivery care system, but also through new models of providing access and quality care to those who need it most. We want to make sure there's a workforce that meets the needs of the population in the 21st century. And then the area where I'll spend most of this time today is in public health, which is the area I oversee. And the goal of our public health area is to both address conditions that optimize health and promote reform systems of public health that are accountable to those conditions. And so that view of how we actually do our work really engages us at policy levels. The community-based participatory research program is where I'll go to next. It's housed within the public health strategic areas of our work. It's really important that we define to our communities what we exactly mean by what's affectionately called CBPR. And we use Barbara Israel's definition out of Michigan. CBPR is defined as a collaborative approach to research that equitably involves all partners in the research process and recognizes the unique strengths that each brings. And I love this saying from the literature: CBPR begins with a research topic of importance to the community, with an aim of combining knowledge and action for social change to improve community health and eliminate health disparities. And what I notice and what I see the most opportunity for is that for in public health is that CBPR focuses or can heavily more focus on social, structural, and physical environmental inequities that sort of involve community members and organizational representatives through a research process. And numerous presentations through this conference and literature have demonstrated that CBPR is proven as a promising approach for addressing such problems. And I think what I would want to turn to next is, how do we know that we're doing so? What kind of process and policy and health outcomes are we actually addressing? The purpose of our foundation's program is to address, again, relevant behavioral, social, and environmental risk factors that contribute to the burden of what we're focusing on right now is chronic disease and the disparities within those prevalence rates. Our RFP and our website shows that our goals of our program are the following: to increase capacity, to develop partnerships among community members and public health researchers to conduct community-based participatory research. A goal of ours is also to increase community capacity for policy advocacy. And by stating this up front, that we're intentional about asking folks to think about how their research can affect policy-making processes, we find that their questions are asked a little bit differently, their partnerships are strategized a little bit differently, and that we actually are not going to ask them later on to do it, but we're upfront about it. And so it actually is a very transparent way, but also does actually help engage partners differently. We also support CBPR to sort of provide proof of concept for both policy and community-based interventions. A big piece that our community always tells us is to help enhance trust among people who are involved in research and in data to enhance data quantity and quality among populations experiencing disparities. So that issue of who owns data comes up quite frequently. And lastly, our goal is to advance research results that translate to real action and policy changes, everything from informing policymaking processes to actually implementing and establishing legislation. And then just really some basics for those of you that might be interested. We are very conscious of power dynamics when we give out grants. So for our grant, this community-based partner or organization is the lead or eligible applicant. A 501c3 or 501c4 entity, coalitions who need fiscal sponsors, they are the ones who actually receive their dollars. But make no mistake that strong research and researchers are a critical part to our review process. We look for folks who have experience, training, and the expertise to do this work in a rigorous way. We actually used to give out just a straight up research grant, full implementation, and have evolved. We found that many of the projects failed because there wasn't enough attention due to the partnership building phase. So we actually now give out smaller grants to do just that and to develop the partnerships. We have outcomes though that are a part of that, and so and those are all on our website. The implementations usually average about $180,000 over 2 to 3 years. Partnership buildings tend to be up to 30 over 12 to 18 months. And then lastly, we started noticing there's great work in the field that's using CBPR approaches that we're not funding, but that they could use support to continue that process to get to dissemination and strictly about policy dissemination. So we'll actually give out grants to carry that process forward. And so today I'm going to highlight one of each of those examples. Really quickly, here's our investments that we've made so far, about $3 million, both in grant making but also in technical assistance. Since we started this work in 2003, we had a little of a break because we actually did not get where we wanted, and so that's when we started doing technical assistance. In 2005, we made the eligible applicant the community-based organization, and that actually spearheaded tons more applications. Every year since our grant making, we host both either community workshops all around our state. We've sponsored three regional conferences, and we've actually, this past May, was the primary sponsor for the Community Campus Partnerships for Health's national conference. Was anyone there? I know Cassandra was. This work has really, really evolved. So the first case study actually that I'd like to talk about is actually a current project, and it's the name of the project is called Making People of Color Count in Policymaking. There's a member called the Coalition of Communities of Color. They're a 501c3 sort of multi-organization, multi-sector group who essentially were fed up with research owned and interpreted by those outside the community or just being omitted. And so they collaboratively decided to develop community profiles about lived realities of six major communities in Multnomah County, the county where Portland, Oregon is. And they approached Portland State University to help them with the research process. And so they were the ones that commissioned the study. And they'll be the first to admit that the process was not easy and not without challenges. For example, they originally proposed to the foundation to get a more qualitative methodology to sort of discuss and profile more qualitatively about what's happening in Portland in the communities. And through the beginning of the process, with the policy change lens, they felt that having more quantifiable data would be much more powerful. And so they went through a little bit of a process, and these are six different communities, all with different histories and time frames for being in our community. And so as you see in the second bullet point, a two-year process, they agreed on 26 major indicators. Again, that in and of itself, that's going to define how best to talk about how their communities are doing was a wonderful outcome in and of itself. But they were intentional that this was to be done to inform elected officials. And the picture here shows when they released the report, the mayor there is in the middle, and the city council people, and the room was packed when the report was released. The other intention was to recommend methods, better methods for how data is collected and included in our county, because as you know, that determines funding priorities, program priorities. A 152-page report was released, and that's the cover, and I'd urge you to go to either our website, nwhf.org, or the Coalition of Communities of Color website to look at that, and that's actually one of seven reports, because there's a comprehensive report, and then there's one for each community. A couple of findings I just want to highlight really quickly. 152 pages, I'm only going to do this in 30 seconds. About 7% of whites drop out of high school compared with 30% of minorities. Some 62% of whites own homes, only 45% minorities do. A larger percentage of minorities spend more than 30% of their income on housing. One in three children of color live in poverty, compared with 12.5% for whites. The child poverty rate for Native Americans is 46%. For African Americans, 41%, and African immigrants, 56%. People of color earn about half that of white individuals. On average, $16,636 a year compared with $33,000. Individual incomes for Latinos is about one-third that of whites. They also compared this work to other cities, similar size and makeup. Minorities in Multnomah County fare worse on measures such as child poverty, rent burden, incomes, and education than minorities in King County, where Seattle is. And basically, the take-home message, that, as you'll see in the title of this Oregonian article, is that that on these 26 indicators, our county is toxic to communities of color. And that was a carefully chosen word. And then another piece is that for the first time, there was actually comprehensive data on the Slavic community, as well as African immigrants, so breaking out African immigrants from African Americans. So I'm going to talk about policy outcomes all at once. So I want to move to our second case study. And our second case study was basically a project that looked at looking at piloting interventions to look at high mold and moisture conditions in rental units. And as one participant said, my doctor said I was getting sick all the time from mold in my apartment. I showed the note to the manager, but she didn't care. Numerous data shows that, you know, the environmental conditions in your home contributes to adverse health effects. There's a group called the Community Alliance of Tenants in Portland, Oregon, and they have a hotline to help mitigate complaints about rental housing issues with landlords. And they were getting lots of calls about mold and moisture in their community, and they wanted to study it further. So we gave them a small partnership building grant to work with the local health department's evaluation unit to do, you know, train community members to do door-to-door surveys and assess the quality and conditions of their home, in their homes. And they just started with a simple N. They worked with 53 units of a housing dwelling. And here's some many findings. Again, I'll just share one. Over 85% of the families surveyed reported mold or moisture problems in their rental units. So by far the number one complaint. And this included sort of structural deficits, gaps between floors and doors. There's also findings about presence of insect or rodent infestation and paint hazards. But in addition, about 50% of the families reported respiratory problems, including asthma, that they attributed to living in their rental housing. About 40% of the families use home products that are asthma triggers or respiratory irritants. And those, home environmental education is a continuing need. And about 30% of the families reported or requested repairs that were fully or partially made. And part of this whole process was there's the community, the tenants don't feel empowered to complain about problems in their homes for fear of eviction, and just didn't want to be perceived as a bad tenant. And so we'll get to the policy outcomes in just a second. The third thing, actually, so when I proposed this abstract, I wanted to highlight the work of Upstream Public Health, who you just heard from, and the brilliance of the organizers of this session, they actually paired us on the same panel. So I'm actually not going to go into it too much, but I But I would like to highlight from our perspective why we thought this was a wonderful project. And to us, this really really highlighted a dissemination amount of activities, because there was already work being done around the policy, and what Upstream and their partners did was actually bring a more community-engaged participatory process to the analysis. And Mel was being even a little humble about the range of partners that they were able to engage. He mentioned equity a couple of times. We felt that both the health and the health equity components of those legislations were not being discussed. And I think what we were able to demonstrate, as he spoke of, was that we can use processes of participatory research to do that. So here's my outcome summary. And I really want to stress a couple of things. In detail. One, we look at both process, and we look at capacity and also dissemination, and then we also look at policy outcomes. We don't quite hold accountable our grantees for health outcomes just yet, because as many of you know, these issues take years and years and years to demonstrate changes. So the more we move upstream, the more our outcomes are upstream. So here's what happened with the communities of color. We actually did both follow-up surveys to grantees, as well as reviewed reports from the grantees. And they identified their capacity being built tremendously on what they call intellectual capital, wisdom, and voice. They have been on a roadshow, basically, since May, to all the various heads of our county government on reporting their findings. And it's been both an empowering process. As one person said it, the task of coming up with policy recommendations was a wonderful task, but not without conflicts. In the end, the process served as a mobilizing call to action. So we're not just going to identify how much of this and what our problems are. You know, they were a part of the solution. And here are some things that came out of that. The mayor is requiring all department and program managers to rewrite their job evaluations to include equity goals and plans to achieve those goals. There's several. The mayor agreed to meet with the coalition every 3 weeks to tackle three issues at a time. That was just the city level. At the county level, we had change in leadership, but they already have an ongoing sort of strong equity initiative at the county government. We're not clear if that this report actually helped contribute to that, but what was identified was looking at undoing institutional racism in county government. And I think this report inserted sort of that rhetoric into their project. The Tenants' Voice Project was able to demonstrate strong social capital and capacity for doing participatory research. Again, they've done several presentations and have press coverage. And we're also to leverage further funding, a more full implementation grant to address the asthma to sort of do interventions to address asthma. Several policy outcomes that were achieved. The findings contributed to decisions by the City of Portland to establish a two-year process to strengthen housing codes, led by a group called the Quality Rental Housing Work Group. It contributed to decisions to implement housing maintenance codes by both the City of Gresham and Multnomah County, and initiated discussions about landlord retaliation and how it discourages tenant repair requests. I can go on and on, but actually, city codes is really where this actually, and county code is actually where this work actually most benefited. And then you heard from Upstream, their work previous to mine, and basically, again, lots of capacity to blend participatory work into what a lot of folks are using is HIAs to do policy analysis and recommendations. A lot of cross-sectoral partnerships were established, many presentations, and I spoke to a national funder who later caught on about their work and who later funded them to do a similar project on another piece of legislation. And you heard about Senate Bill 1059. Lessons learned from a funder's perspective, we find that CVPR to be an effective tool for improving advocacy capacity and research leading to policy. I think that is a message to both practitioners who are looking at all the tools in a toolbox, but actually one of the missions that we have at the foundation is actually a message to funders. Funders who are involved in more of the social determinants and equity pieces and who are maybe not so familiar with other tools such as CVPR. We actually think that funding CVPR actually leads to social capital improvements alone, an intervention of itself. By and which is, has been shown to actually is a social determinant of health that positively affects community health. And so we're talking about civic participation and social cohesion. But it's important as funders that we have an expectation of and we actually account for capacity of for dissemination. A lot of times research sort of drops the ball on that part of it. And that we think, and actually now key principles of CBPR have actually penetrated several grant programs throughout our foundation. So, you know, all the principles of CBPR, now if I'm going to call it CBPR, I'm going to make sure there's rigorous partnerships and all the data and all that stuff. There's actually components of CBPR that actually translate into other types of work, and so we've actually used that in all our grants. And last slide, again, I can't stress enough that the partnership building phase is absolutely critical, and it's, I know it's hard to find funding for that, there's lots of creative ways that our grantees actually, that I'd be happy to talk about, have actually done that. And so assuring funding, so and to other funding colleagues out there, I would avail our review tools and how we look at grants, because we want to assure that there's a process that's transformative. And lastly, two last points. We believe that CBOs are qualified to serve as a co-PI on a project that includes research, and that outcomes should include both policy and process measures. I want to acknowledge the folks that helped me prepare this presentation there, and our website is there for any further, and please contact me for further questions. Thank you. I'll probably take questions at the end because I want to make sure there's enough time for our final presenter.